following is an oral history interview with Now, Mr. Iwasaki, when we had our last interview, we talked about your experiences during World War II. So let's start today, and I want to ask you about your discharge from the service and what you did when you came home.
When I came back from the service, I was kind of lost. I didn't have a goal in mind, and of course I was single at that time, and so my concern probably was more with girlfriends and getting married than pursuing a life in my career. But however, we did come back to the farm, and I wanted to help my dad reestablish the farm. So to that end, my brother and I both came back about the same time, so we directed our efforts to try to recapture our farm. So we continued to raise farm crops and rented ground outside of our home, and
you rented ground from neighbors?
Yes, yes, and expanded because we were able to create a market for our vegetables, so we felt that was the best thing at the time.
I was about to ask you what kind of crops you...
Principally strawberries, and that was a very successful venture. It was quite, there was quite a number of other strawberry farms in the area, so, and we also had a local processing company called B.E. Mailing Company, and that's spelled M-A-I-L-I-N-G. And so we had a market for our crops, and so after the war, that's more what we pursued.
Why did you choose strawberries over other crops?
Before the war, we raised strawberries here, and I'm not sure in our previous interview whether I mentioned the fact that there were quite a few families that Japanese background that came to Washington County and found that strawberry raising was quite rewarding. So when we came back after the war, after the evacuation and return, 4 years later, we pursued that endeavor. And found it rewarding. Mm-hmm.
Did you, were you able to get the necessary supplies that you needed to grow your strawberries? And
at that time, right after the war, everything, supplies and material things were in short. The country was trying to recover from the war effort, so it was more difficult to get established, and we couldn't buy some of the things that we needed to do our farming. Mm-hmm. But it was not a big big problem, but we did have to live with shortages.
Where did you market your strawberries?
It was all processing companies. Very little on the fresh market. It was all through canneries. And they, I guess it was just about that time, 1946 and 7, that frozen foods was becoming a popular preserving method or marketing method. Up until that time, strawberries were principally kept in a bulk in barrels, and I think it was, I'm not sure, distributed to restaurants and hotels and commercial. But about that time, especially this cannery where we marketed, they were packaging strawberries into retail frozen food. And I think this company I referred to, the mailing company, was sold out to Bird's Eye, and Bird's Eye was a big company from back east that started all this small frozen food package for the retail market.
Were there other processors that you used in the area as well?
Well, I think there was, but I really don't remember.
Mm-hmm. How did you harvest the strawberries? Did you have?
Well, that was an effort. It was time to get. We had to get a lot of. It was all hand labor, so we had to recruit families and kids. But through the years, we used to go after what I term as Skid Row bums off of Burnside Street in Portland. They were quite prevalent at the time. Mm-hmm. And so we would send in buses and get these fellows. We referred them to as winos, because principally that was their interest, that they get a bottle of wine, they'd go after it just to go out to pick strawberries. Uh-huh. and be able to come home and buy a bottle of wine. That was their goal.
Were they reliable as pickers?
Well, not really, but they were not consistent. In other words, they would come one day and then have a day of celebration or so, and then after they recovered, then they would come back maybe 2-3 days later. So, but there was enough of them that kept our cycle of supply of pickers. They kept coming, so we struggled along with having them help us. Mm-hmm. But it was a kind of an interesting experience, because that was all there was interest in, is to get something to drink.
Did you have to manage them, or did they work?
No, it was not. They're very, as I remember, they're very docile. Very docile. They're not, you know, belligerent or lazy. Well, some were lazy, but it was a good source, I would say, because to get families to pick, it wasn't that lucrative, and so family people tended to drift more.
As a child, I picked beans, and there were usually transient families that would follow harvest.
Yes.
Did you ever have any families like that?
We did, but not that many. they were not a very good staple source of help. They would be very anxious to make enough for their survival, and so they were not stable, and we could not rely on them. So we felt that these men from Burnside Street in Portland actually was more helpful to us.
How long did you have them do that? How many years did you?
Over the years, or well, I'm going to guess maybe 6-8 years, possibly. Yeah. So.
Interesting. So, what happened after that?
Well.
Didn't have the Skid Row people.
For a while, we had strawberries. We raised strawberries on rented property, and. We built a camp, kind of a camp, a labor camp for our own help. It was quite an investment. We had cabins that were, I'm going to guess, about 12 by 16, which wasn't a big cabin, but that would be enough to house families. And this was principally designed for Mexican foreign labor. They were here legally, but there was quite a few just gradually coming in from California and moving this way. So during the season, we built a dozen or 20 houses, I don't remember how many, but we built these and provided a shower and laundry facilities and this kind of thing in a camp. And this was a source of our labor in the 60s, 1960s.
And how did they work out for you?
That using those people was very successful. They're very hardworking, and at that time there was no restrictions, so the families would bring out their kids and they would help pick, and so it kind of made it worthwhile for the family, man and his wife, to eke out a reasonable return. But this was very seasonal. Then they would have to go to other crops like beans or cucumbers or whatever for the summer, and then many of them went back again to California to the warmer climates for winter crops. So that was that one era, and then after that, around in the 70s on, we gradually diverted our efforts to our greenhouse operation, and then abandoned the strawberries as a business, and so then we gradually expanded our greenhouse, built more houses as our resources got better.
Can I interrupt for 1 minute? When you got back, I forgot to ask you this. When you got back and you started engaging in farming, were you accepted as just a regular farmer in the county? I mean, was there any?
It was kind of gradual acceptance, I guess. And so, you know, after the war, 10 years or 20 years after the war, we didn't experience or see any discrimination. It was, maybe there was something covertly, but we didn't see it, or it didn't really affect us that much. That is, we didn't find it that objectionable after the years.
Now, from the 70s, when you diverted your efforts, why did you decide to do that at that point?
We found that it was more economically rewarding.
Did you need a labor force for the greenhouse work, or how did that?
No, that was not as intensive. Strawberries, principally harvest time, was a very critical period. You could not wait for help. It was more of a concern
mm-hmm.
to get the berries off, or otherwise you lose them. And so, to that standpoint, it was not that appealing, raising strawberries. But this greenhouse work, we started with principally in raising ornamental flowers, and then gradually we started raising vegetable plants in this to expand our market.
Now, the ornamental flowers, does that...
Annuals, principally annuals.
Does that sort of coincide with the Oregon nursery industry? I mean, were other people doing this at the same time, going into this?
Well, not so much annuals. There were a lot of other nurseries that raised hardy plants, shrubs, and that kind. But there were not that many raising annuals and small plants.
What were the sort of, if you don't mind me putting it this way, the bread and butter sort of annual plants that you...
Principally, I'm going to say it was pansies and primroses and marigolds and petunias. Those are the main bulk of our items.
Mm-hmm. And what was your market for these?
To the retailers, and at that time, chain stores weren't that prevalent. I think principally we sold to Fred Meyer and maybe some to Safeway, and this was more local, that is around the Portland area, that we delivered to.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were numerous garden stores, private garden stores, that we also sold to.
So, after you were in the nursery business, you said you also got into vegetables slowly.
Yes.
Vegetable plants, that is,
you know, tomatoes and peppers, eggplants and onions, those kind of crops that were starter plants that we supplied the nurseries and garden centers.
So the public was interested in these things at the time, how would you gauge public interest in growing things?
I beg your pardon?
How would you assess the public's interest in growing?
Well, I think it's something that at first they were not, I should not say accustomed, but it was not customary that they would go out and buy plants and put it in the garden. In those earlier days, they would buy seeds and do their own starts. But in recent years, now we've noticed that more and more people are don't have the time or the patience to do the seed, so they'd rather go out there and have one plant that's already big enough to sit out and buy. People, their priorities, I guess, have changed, and we're living now in a more, I'd say, a faster paced world, so who's going to monkey around with seeds? You know, they'd rather go out to the country or boating or skiing or whatever, I mean, recreation-wise, and so actually that's where we do compete, you know, with that recreation industry and the flower growing business. We're actually competing for their time.
So it's a pastime.
Or pastime. Kind of thing. Pastime, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
No? Yeah.
I can see that.
And more people are living in apartments, and maybe they don't have access to much of a garden, you know, so that accelerates our market, we'll say, mm-hmm. to provide instant plants and, say, not only food products, but I'm speaking of petunias or marigolds in potted plants to set out on the deck because they live on the third floor of the apartments, you know, and you have no access to ground or ground floor. So that contributes, I think, to our market.
You mentioned that you grew tomatoes, peppers, and onions starter crops in the beginning. Have you noticed any trends? I mean, do they prefer tomatoes then and now they like cucumbers more, or?
Well, not really. I have not noticed any particular trend that way. Mm-hmm. But now, it's interesting. We even raise melons, different kind of melons, like, and I'm referring to squash and cucumbers and watermelon, cantaloupes, and this kind of thing. And you know, those things don't require a lot of time to develop. You know, you drop a seed, say in the month of May or June, and that will become a plant in, say, 5 days. But people are funny, they don't want to spend that time, so they'll go out and plant buy a little container of a melon plant that's up a little bit. But we market that from, I'm going to guess, inside of a week from the time we drop the seed, we market it. So it's a very lucrative item, because it has very little shelf time on our place, and yet we turn it into money. So that the margin of profit on that is, for the time that we're involved with it, watering and this kind of thing, is minimal.
Do you do those outside or inside?
No, it's all in the confined area, mm-hmm. in the greenhouse, in our houses. Yeah. So that's a profitable item versus petunias or other things that take a long time to nurse and nurture before it's ready. Mm-hmm. So or even corn. You know, corn, you drop the seed in and that thing jumps up in 3 days, and instead of a week, it's ready to market.
Mm-hmm. So a consumer will buy anything that appears above the soil, is that it? I mean, or does it have to be?
Well, I think there's a certain appeal to things that pop out of the ground, uh-huh. and by human nature, they like to see some, oh gee, the corn's up, I think I'll buy some, type of thing. I mean, they don't realize it. They took that seed, which is a lot less expensive, and drop it in there, they'd have the same thing in a week, you know, but people are funny. They have to have instant gardens on their mind, I think.
Uh-huh. So instant gratification. But there's also the certainty that it did sprout. I mean, that you didn't get bad seed, or you didn't plant it in the wrong spot. you've got something that you can nurture when you can see it
too. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So right now then, how would you characterize your endeavors? I mean, in terms of fruits and vegetables. Vegetables and flowers. Are you both, or more one than the other, or which type of crop?
Linda, I think one series of crops complements the other, and so without one or the other, the outlets would say, well, let's bring in someone else to supply us on this, and so they'd rather have one supplier bring in, we'll say, a fuller line or a full line of items so that they don't have to go out and buy vegetables from this person and flowers from this person, this kind of thing. So they tend to like a full line of items.
Mm-hmm. So do you plan out what you're going to grow ahead of time and contract for it, or how does that work?
Many of the items, and I'm referring to chain stores now, and they feature loss leaders, we'll say, during the market season, principally in April and May, and they'll feature, we'll say, eggplants, special whatever price, and so the contract, we have an agreement, they'll say, okay, for May 15th, I'd like to have 100 of these flats of these or whatever, and they give us a contract anticipating a sale item. So that's something that is good for the producer, because we know there's a market for that, so we will raise the item in quantities to meet that contract. Mm-hmm. So during the season we have many contract items like that, in addition to the daily supply that we would furnish.
Mm-hmm. So you know ahead what people are needing and expecting from you to supply.
Well, I guess
when you sign your contract, you know this.
Yeah, through the years we kind of learn what is popular, and we raise things proportionately. And of course, we refer to our records from year to year and say, well, we raised this many of this item this year, and say that it was not popular, so maybe we should cut back on that inventory of that. And so I guess we learn as we go, and market does change. The popular items do, or say some petunias that were very popular this year will next year another kind of a product will become very popular. And these garden magazines and the media print feature some things, and that's what appeals. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of important that we watch what the magazines and newspapers feature. Mm-hmm. And invariably, those are the ones that the housewives, those that remember that, will try to seek out that particular kind of a petunia or a particular kind of a pumpkin. So did you have that? And so, you know, you multiply that times many stores and many people, and it becomes an item that we have to provide to be popular.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So if Martha Stewart is using certain kind of vegetable or flower,
mm-hmm. yeah, yeah,
it affects what your
that's
what
right.
your market is.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So those garden people, what they write is quite influential.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where do you get your seed for your plants?
We have commercial seed suppliers, and by name, I mean, if you want names, one is Vaughn Seed, VAUGHNS, and Ball Seed. But I don't know whether those companies have a retail line. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you get particular varieties of things that are suited to our climate?
I suppose we do. I'm not the buyer. We have our seed catalog has a graph showing the 12 months of the year, and then it shows the temperatures of the Pacific region or temperatures of the Midwest or wherever, and so that graph kind of tells us what product is good for this time of the year for the climate for the Pacific coast, we'll say.
Mm.
I mean, in a general sense, that's kind of what we kind of refer to.
Mm.
And
well, if you knew, for example, ahead that we have an El Nino winter
mm-hmm.
ahead of us, would that affect the way you choose your plants or the way you have the nursery?
Well, Linda, I don't think we're sophisticated enough in our operation to foresee that or to study that as a marketing strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I don't think that's really, in our case, a consideration.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's a good thought that maybe we should consider that.
Well, I was just thinking about all the environmental impacts of while you were talking about the weather conditions, especially this year, and we've had so many more insects, for example, and
yes,
you know, mm-hmm. maybe you need to, I mean, I would, or it would be possible to grow crops that were more insect resistant, if that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea, but
well, I'm sorry, I can't answer you too much on that. I suppose research is constantly trying to raise things that would ward off enemies, insects or bacteria or whatever, but for our purpose we don't do much in that regard.
You were saying it was just more market driven.
Yeah, you might say,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I thought I heard you mention a while back that you have a relationship with a grower in Japan, or you have a connection with someone that you're growing, is it mushrooms?
Okay, I think we were referring to wasabi. This is
yes.
a Japanese horseradish. And several years ago, Mr. Nakagawa, Nakagawa from Tokyo, sought us out regarding raising wasabi plants because we had a greenhouse and we were familiar with raising plants from seed. So we agreed to raise some wasabi plants from seeds that he brought from Japan. And since that time, he then asked us, could we find a place to raise wasabi plants, principally in water or near a creek side where we would have clear running water. So one thing led to another, and so I agreed to build a little plastic house or houses beside a creek in Forest Grove area that I found for him. And so from there we have, I have been spending my, you might say, retirement years kind of helping this person and his venture. Mm-hmm. And we have marketed some wasabi principally in California area, and of course I'm not involved in the marketing, but this Mr. Nakagawa has been marketing this, some in California and some also back east. And while it hasn't shown the type of profit, he has continued to wanting to expand. So this spring we built more houses. Let's see, 2,000. So we built another 12,000 square feet of space, controlled atmosphere space in a greenhouse. And we planted some more plants, and currently we're building another house that's about 6,000 square feet this year, this fall. And I don't know, I'm not so sure about whether the how the venture is going to go, but this fall we're going to start marketing a considerable amount of wasabi. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you better in another year.
Well, tell me, look, I am interested in wasabi. What do you, how would you prepare it, or how would you use it exactly?
Well, it's a kind of a tuber thing that grows above the ground. Mm-hmm. Nothing in the ground, it's all above the ground, and it's a tuber that ideally size-wise about an inch in diameter and say maybe 4 or 5 inches long. And that tuber, we grade it through a grater, and then it's eaten as what do you call it? You dip it in.
It's like horseradish.
Yeah, kind of like horseradish. It's just like you eat meats with horseradish on it, meats or steaks or what do you call it, rolls and that kind of thing.
Beef.
Yeah, beef. But on this horseradish, I mean this wasabi, we grate it and then just put it on principally raw fish.
Oh.
Or they use it in soba, which is a buckwheat noodle type of thing. That's where it's used principally.
So this is obviously a very familiar vegetable in Japan.
Very familiar.
Mm-hmm. And so your friend is endeavoring to introduce it to American markets, is that?
Not necessarily introduce it, because it's something that is commonly found in American Japanese stores and restaurants. There is a wasabi, it's a kind of a processed kind of a paste form, in a paste form that's available on the market. I don't know where it comes from, but it's has a wasabi flavor, and it, I think it's mixed with mayonnaise or some other paste, we'll say. So it's not the true wasabi, but that's a, you know, the, I think the American people probably don't know the true wasabi. They the, all they know is this manufactured wasabi. Mm-hmm. But more and more, I think, as the growers expand, why there'll be more introduced pure wasabi in this country.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so, do you think we will see it as a used in more, let's say, used more extensively in our diets?
Yeah, I think so. I think they'll probably, say, discover the taste of that and maybe use it as not seasoning, but what do you call it, as a supplement to other foods, yeah,
uh-huh.
And maybe even beef, you know. But
interesting. So the goal is not to market it in Japan, or it's not
principally
to export.
It's yes, principally for the market in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'd say we did send some to New York, a New York restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but of course I'm not involved in the marketing. This Nakagawa company satellite in L.A. that markets other imports and exports other products does the marketing. So I send the bulk to them, and they in turn ship it to markets, you know, back east,
mm-hmm.
as well as California.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, but it seems like the square footage you mentioned is impressive. Is that a fairly vigorous attempt?
I'm sorry, Lynn.
The square footage of the greenhouses
for
growing the wasabi.
Well, there's something inconsistent in what I envision here. We have sold very little in the way of dollar return, but Mr. Nakagawa wants to expand without more study. And in my preference, and I told him that, why don't we wait a year and see how our current crop grows and how it markets and how the market acceptance will be, but no, he's very anxious to get started. He wants to expand, and so it's not my way of a venture, but of course he has what I call deep pockets, and so that's why we're continuing to build. Incidentally, this Mr. Nakagawa has other ventures. He's has a what do you call it, decals, or he makes chemicals and makes, and I'm not real sure how to describe it, but it's what these decals that you see on buses or trucks or advertising type of thing, not so much on billboards, but these different designs or things that you see on say trucks or things like that.
Yes.
I guess they're called decals, but that's one of his main business.
Ah, okay.
However, in LA he processes lobsters purchased from across the border in Mexico, as another side business. He has a restaurant in Japan.
Goodness.
So he has many or a few other ventures. So wasabi growing is not is only one item of his line of interest.
Uh-huh. Why did he want to have the greenhouses by a stream?
Well, that's the normal way of what it's kind of like watercress. Wasabi does best the best in water. So in Japan,
okay.
there are some land grown wasabi, but the majority, say 90% of the wasabi grown in Japan are near creekside beds.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I don't know whether it has something to do with the taste. There are some dry land wasabi, and of course in our case, these houses we built, we grow them under an overhead water situation. So it's a little bit different. It's just, you know, just irrigation, overhead irrigation versus a constant creek water flowing bed.
This is very different, isn't it, from other things that we grow here?
Very different, yes, yes. There's only one other venture that I know of, and that is in Florence, Oregon, whereby this individual, maybe I mentioned this to you before, but he's got a little wasabi growing venture, and he's a Caucasian. He's a former real estate developer with good resources, I believe. So he's established the wasabi farm, and my understanding is he sends a lot of it to Japan, but however, I don't know, I'm just guessing. I visited the farm, but I didn't want to get too private.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's...
So it's unusual.
Yes, yes, very unusual. Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah, it's very unusual. There is one in Washington that we visited a couple, 3 years ago in Shelton, close to Olympia. And but unless it becomes a lucrative venture, I don't think we'd be too much. Well, of course, the demand is not that great. It's not like something that you use in volume. It's not like potatoes or onions. It's something that doesn't require much to... A little goes a long ways, we'll
uh-huh.
say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So... I'm thinking you've been pretty wrapped up in this endeavor.
I have, yeah. In my retirement years, see, I'm actually wanting to have a little more time off to myself, but, and I guess I could tell Mr. Nagawa that I don't want to do it anymore, but then there's a certain kind of a responsibility that I assume, so I just kind of continue, but I'm hoping that I could get out of some of the responsibilities. We did hire a full-time person to do most of the cultural practices that wasabi growing requires now. We hired him in this summer, but still there's a lot of other work, paperwork and so forth. And then, of course, I go there almost every day. In fact, as soon as our interview is over, I'm due to go over there because we have, in this new building that we're building, we have some sand media that's being delivered from Tillamook, and I have to oversee that. And well, it's principally sand from the Tillamook area. It's no clay in it. It's just sand from that area. It's not beach sand. It's river sand. It's more coarse.
Oh.
And it comes from, I don't know if you're familiar with the coast, from the Kilchers River area.
Yes.
And but it's green. It's sometime, I don't know if they have every time I'd show you, but then I don't know, that's maybe beyond your
Well, no, I'm always interested.
But anyway, I'm involved in that, and so we're building this new house, and then I'm involved in the builder is coming tomorrow, and he's already started to build, and so I'm busy.
Yes. Well, now let's get back to the business that your original business. Who's minding the store while you're retired and when you're away?
Initially, this business, I had three brothers. I'm the middle one, and my younger brother decided that he no longer wanted to continue together, so he ventured out on his own, and so what was left is my brother and I, and we're both up in the years. So several years ago, my older brother's son, Jim, decided that he decided to come get involved, and so he...
Now Jim is the son of... Jim's father is...
George.
Yeah. Your brother George. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Currently he is the general manager, and he seems to be doing a good job running the company.
Uh-huh.
And we have been, every year we have been expanding a little, so that speaks well for itself, uh-huh. We'll say.
And George is retired.
Uh-huh. And
is it still a family operation, would you think?
Yes, it is strictly a family operation, yes.
All family owned.
Yeah, all family owned and operated, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, if you were going to count back in years, when would you say your family business started? What year? Do you have a...
Well, on a small scale, I presume, Linda, you're referring to the greenhouse or other ventures?
Well, I'm not sure, because I don't know how you would, since you kind of went from strawberries to the nursery business, I don't know.
Well...
But I guess as a family, let's say a family farming operation as a business.
As a business, that started, I'm going to venture to guess that it's around the 1930s. Gradually, as we made money and became able to expand, we used our resources and expanded. And Then, of course, the war came along in 1940, and then so there was a time period until about 1946 that we were inactive.
Mm-hmm.
And then after we came back, especially my brother and I, and then of course I had my older brother that was not in the service, but then the three of us combined our effort to expand in berry farming, and then in the 70s, we gravitated towards the nursery.
Mm-hmm.
And then since then, we have been pursuing that nursery from about the 70s on. We expanded, and I guess that's where we are today.
Mm-hmm. It goes back quite a ways.
I beg your pardon?
It goes back quite a ways.
Yes, it does. Yeah, yeah, because I can remember when I was going to school in the early 30s that my dad, of course, was principally doing all the work, and we were just kids in there. Yeah.
So that would be 55, 60 years of pretty much continue, well, at least 60 years then of pretty much continuous.
Yeah, you work. Might say. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've been here ever, I mean, this was a place in 1916 when my dad bought this place, and it's still here, and we're still, we haven't moved.
Gosh. That is fairly unusual.
See, I think I told you before in the interview that my folks moved here when I was in about 6 months old. 1916.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've never lived anywhere else. I mean, all these years.
Uh-huh. Oh my goodness. Well, what do you? Are there whole parts of your history here that I haven't quite yet covered? But while we're still talking about your business, what do you envision in the future?
Personally or business-wise?
For your business, in what direction do you see it?
My nephew, Jim, is, I'm going to guess, probably around 52 or 3 years old, so I envision him continuing until retirement, maybe around 60, and I'm not sure, there's no backup. In other words, he doesn't have any boys, he has girls. No, so there's no backup. My kids are not interested, and Jim's two other brothers, by the way, my brother George has 5 children, 3 boys and 2 girls, and Jim is one of the boys, but so the other brothers, Jim's brothers, I don't think they're interested in pursuing the business after Jim, who is the oldest, retires. I envision the nursery as folding up. I mean, I think the ground here is becoming so expensive, and you know, it's the migration is so intense now around here that any piece of ground has become very valuable, and we have, I don't know, at least 20 to 30 acres that's can be utilized for housing, which is a higher use than maybe what we're doing. So I envision in, say, less than 10 years, that maybe we will probably be forced to move out because of taxes. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to become so expensive that either we make a lot of money in the nursery or else be forced out because it doesn't pay to pay that kind of a high tax to continue here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I'm just guessing.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were younger, of course, it would make sense to go out further out in the country and reestablish. Of course, that'd be farther away from our market, our delivery market, but then if we were younger, that would probably be the most sensible thing to do. But then, given our family conditions, I don't envision that we'll be continuing to have a nursery. Of course, it's beyond my lifetime.
Oh, I wouldn't say that at all, but I mean, it's interesting that you sort of are out there looking to, the, you know, have the vision of what you would anticipate, I think.
Well, I'm guessing a lot of this. Uh-huh. I mean, but I don't see a distant future. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm.
Well, that would be a loss if we don't have a greenhouse here. It's just interesting. I mean, I'm sure it's been a landmark, you know, sort of operation.
Well, yeah, that's true. I suppose the next six, let's see, this is, well, not six, this is 1998, so 18 more years and we would be a century operation,
that's,
I guess.
Right.
But then, yeah. I'm not too concerned.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I neglected this whole other side of your activities, and that would be your social life while you were working and developing your business, and I didn't ask you about your family, or, you know, and I know that you're married. And
yeah, because in the early years we had to really work, apply ourselves in the farm, and I guess my social life was very limited, and because of my ethnic background, most of the Japanese colonies were in Portland, and very, very few out in the country, and so I met my wife in Portland. Japanese, as a rule, or I guess it's almost a custom that, you know, they have what we call a go-between for marriages, and of course this is a custom in Japan. However, that custom.
The following is tape 2 in an interview with Ike Iwasaki. The date is October 6, 1998. The interviewer is Linda Dodds. Okay, we were in the midst of talking about your social life, and you said in the old days there was the tradition of the go-between in the marriage.
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
All right.
So, but however, that kind of practice is was not too popular, especially in the States, and so I guess through a short period of, we'll say, courtship, I liked what I saw of my wife, so we got married, and let's see, what else shall I say?
Is Mary a Portland?
She's born in Portland, and she had one brother,
and what was her maiden name?
Her maiden name is Furusho. That's spelled F-U-R-U-S-H-O. Her dad had an apartment in Portland. And see, what else can I say? I'm just at a loss for words.
So you had a short courtship, and then you got married, and
mm-hmm. And we have three kids. I have two boys and a girl. Roger, the oldest, and here I'm kind of stuck for ages, but he was born in 1951. And Richard, the second one, was born in 1953. And my daughter, Ellen, was born in 8 years later.
1961.
All right, that's...
Okay.
I hope my wife scolds me if I miss some dates, but that's close.
Uh-huh. Well, you had the dates, so that's
pretty good, I would think.
You're not interested in dates, are you?
No. Well, you.
That's close enough.
So, did you move out to Hillsboro? Well, you were always here in Hillsboro.
After we got married, I lived for a short time in about 5 miles away in a rented house. But then in 1953, I decided to build a house, and this is the house where we are living now, where we are doing the interview.
So you've been here,
45
years.
Yes. Same house.
Oh, that's unusual.
Is it?
I think in these days.
Well, in this day and age, people are more mobile.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, Roger, let's see, I will just tell you a little bit. Roger went to, he was interested in architecture, in landscape architecture, so he went to U of O and got a degree there. And my son Richard was more into education. He went to Oregon, but he didn't complete his schooling, and he quit. And then Richard kind of went into a commercial photography type of thing.
Ellen,
she completed her education, went to a nursing school, University of Oregon Nursing, and then she went to work as a, I have to back up. She did get her, did some more graduate work, and got her master's, and she is currently with the Oregon Legacy Center as a nurse practitioner.
And they all grew up here on the property. Do they still live around here nearby? Or?
Yes. All of my children live within the Portland area.
Mm-hmm. Well, usually in an interview I ask, is there anything you'd like to add? What did I forget to ask you?
Not really.
Include in this interview.
I guess my venture with this wasabi kind of. I'd like to do a little more fishing and golfing, as poor as I am, but it kind of restricts my activity that way.
Yes. Are you still getting some in though, nevertheless?
Yes, I am.
Good.
However, fishing, and principally this is spring Chinook salmon fishing, it hasn't been a very appealing thing now because they've curtailed the season and limits, and so it has not been that good. But, and currently I'm a member of a senior, what we call Nisei, such as myself, that's a Japanese-American second-generation people. So I'm in a club, senior golf club, and
where do you go?
Various places throughout the Portland area. Tomorrow is we play about 10 places in during the summer. Tomorrow is the last session, which I have to go to at the Colwood. Then we have a party, mm-hmm. this kind of thing. So that's the extent of our. But however, I do a lot of other social golfing. We were to the coast the other day and with friends, and we did stayed overnight and played some golf. Mm-hmm.
What's, I guess in golf you always ask, what's your handicap?
Well, I was hoping, Linda, you wouldn't ask that,
okay.
But then, no, you're not embarrassing me.
We can leave that out.
Well, yeah, no, it's not that I'm proud of, but it's around, I'm just going to guess around 130, uh-huh. somewhere in that area. Some days are good, some are bad.
Well, I'm glad you're getting some golf in despite your busy days.
I started late in life, so naturally I'm not very agile. And but the point is that I love to get out and, you know, fraternize, we'll say, mm-hmm. and fraternize in frustration, we'll say.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing I didn't ask you, though, and this is a social thing, is your connections with, the Nisei community or the Japanese American community.
Yeah, well, yeah, I participate. We have, there's a what we call a Japanese American Ancestral Society in Portland, and I'm a member of that. And we have our annual tournaments and this kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe you got enough. You're running out of page.
Well, yeah, and you have taken trips to Japan, and you've also. Did you not say visited with family in Japan? So
I beg your pardon.
You said that you have visited Japan a number of times.
Yes.
Visited your family there during these trips and traced your ancestry, perhaps. In
yes, I've visited Japan with my to my relatives then. Let's see. I only have one direct cousin living, and all the rest have passed away, and I have not maintained any contact with my cousin's children, so it becomes kind of remote. I don't want to be redundant here, but I don't know what I mentioned previously regarding my ventures into Japan. You know, I do belong to a Lions Club in Portland, has many Americans of Japanese ancestry involved in there, and we have, as Lions Club, we call it twinning. It's twinning with another Lions Club in another foreign country, and so we did initiate a couple of clubs in Japan. One's is Sapporo, and one is in a city called Shimonoseki, Shimonoseki, Southern Japan. And so, in that relationship, I have been over there a couple of times, or several times, to attend celebrations and anniversaries and this kind of thing, in addition to my other travels to Japan, just sightseeing. Lately, because my involvement with Wasabi and this Mr. Nakagawa has invited me to Japan, so I have been there a couple of times as his guest, and adventured around Tokyo.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I don't know what else. I guess I need some prompting if you need anything. I don't know. My mind is not that.
Well, I was glad that you mentioned all of these connections, the Japanese Ancestry Society and the Lions Club with the 20, because that's really important.
Yes. And then, of course, we have what a national organization, the Japanese American Citizens League, and so I have contributed to that. They are building, let's see, I can't repeat it, but anyway. It's an organization. They're building a building in L.A. that would retain and commemorate the Japanese in America. And so I'm a member of that. We have contributed various information to that organization. I'm also a member of the Japanese American War Veterans. Turn that off a minute. I want to go get something. Well, currently we have a center in Portland called the Oregon Nisei Legacy Center, whereby we have gathered artifacts of our past era. And so it's an organization that we support in to preserve our Japanese American legacy.
And you're active in that group?
Yes, we participate and try to support it.
That's great.
I think that's the end of what I might want to contribute.
Okay. Well, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for your time and your sharing your history with this project.
Thank you very much, Linda. Well, I enjoyed visiting with you, and what I contributed, I hope, will be of some value, but I'm not able to think on my feet, so it's very limited.
I think you did very well. Thank you so much.